Hi, it's Richard here. All this week, we're bringing you some of our favourite episodes of 2025. Today, it's Sarah's conversation with that brilliant writer from County Wicklow in Ireland, Claire Keegan.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Claire Keegan is one of the best fiction writers around. Her stories are often short, but they carry huge emotional power. Her 2022 novella, Small Things Like These, has been made into a movie. And the backdrop to that story is the brutal history of the Magdalen Laundries, which were operating in Ireland right up until the 1990s. Places where girls and women were basically imprisoned and in forced labour, and if they were pregnant, had their babies taken away for adoption. But in Small Things Like These, Claire's focus is on a coal man named Bill Furlong and the moral crisis that he's thrown into one Christmas after he encounters a girl locked in a coal shed at the local convent. Claire often comes at her stories slantwise rather than straight on, and they're told in spare, precise paragraphs. She's won many prizes for her fiction, including a bunch bestowed in her homeland, where she's been awarded Woman of the Year for Literature in Ireland and Author of the Year, and where her writing is now part of the senior school curriculum. All this success might seem a long way from where Claire was born, the youngest of six children on a farm in Wicklow without running water or many books. Claire's been in Australia teaching a reading workshop and pursuing the other great love of her life, horses. And I very much appreciate that straight from a long, long flight, she's joining me in the studio. Hi, Claire.
Hello, Sarah. It's lovely to be here.
This farm that you grew up on in the southeast of Ireland, what did it look like?
It was just 50 acres on the side of a hill, looking out on Mount Leinster. It was a lovely place, really. You had to go up through the forestry to get to the farm. So there was a back lane and a front avenue. It was the old Anglo-Irish Protestant house. And when the state was formed, the Land Commission, that would have been the Republic's Land Commission, divided up the big estates and parcelled them out to the poor people of the area. And so my mother and father got what was then known as the big house and the 50 acres around it.
So the big house, was it quite grand then inside?
It would have been, but my father couldn't afford to pay the rates, so he just pulled the whole thing down with the paddy horse. But it would have been a fine old house.
And 50 acres doesn't sound like too much. What were they growing or raising on that farm?
We had cattle and sheep and pigs. My mother had poultry. She used to raise turkeys and send them on the train to Dublin before Christmas. My brother had horses when I was growing up, and then we made hay and we planted corn, but corn for us is barley and oats and wheat, and we'd harvest that at the end of the summer, beginning of the autumn.
So was it a family where everyone had a job to do? Everyone was working when they were at home?
I think those who were inclined that way probably were out doing things like that, but not everybody was inclined that way. But I liked being outside.
What sort of jobs were your responsibility as a kid?
Well, I mean, I used to split sticks from an early age, but my brothers all, at one point or another, including my father, used to work as lumberjacks also. So I used to keep the lines clear in the forest with a draft horse. There are two men up at the top of the line, and they're either felling, clear felling trees or trimming the line. And I'd go up with the draft horse and hook up to the trees that were felled and pull them with the horse down to the car road and then keep doing that until the day was over. And at the end of that day, we used to cut the trees up into lengths and put them in piles, and then the lorry would come and collect them.
Did you have a favourite spot on the farm, a place that felt like your place?
I'm not sure. I mean, one of the lovely things about that place was that There were so many lovely old granite buildings left over from those times. The house was built in the 1700s. So we had a barn and a granary loft and steps and stables and an old mill. There was an orchard, and I would have spent time in all of those places at different times of the year.
And were you a big reader as a kid, Claire?
Well, I would have been if I had books, but I didn't have any books. We didn't have any money to spare. You know, we had money for food and basic things. We didn't use the library. I think we didn't really know there was a library to use. And I think, though, that probably wasn't a bad thing, because I had to learn how to entertain myself. Not that I was bored. I'm not that type of personality. I don't get bored easily. I don't need to be constantly entertained or have a lot going on or be busy. So I probably learned to use my imagination to entertain myself.
What kind of things fed your imagination?
I think what feeds your imagination is what you long for and how you're inclined. And my mother got me, I don't know how she did this, she probably got this out of pig money, but she got me a pony when I was small. Because I think she just couldn't bear me going on about having a pony any longer. Her heart was scalded with me asking about a pony. And she got me a skewbald pony, and of course we didn't have money for a saddle. So all I had was a pony and with a bridle and no noseband on it, which I now know isn't such a bad thing at all. And off I went bareback and used her kind of as transport too. You'd go up and count the sheep or go down to a neighbour's house on the pony or go down and make a phone call to the vet from the phone box. So that's what I used to do. And I had two long plaits and I imagined myself to be a Native American girl out on my skewbald pony, you know.
Did you enjoy your own company? Were you one of those kids who's happy to be solitary?
Yeah, I always have been. I've always been that way inclined. I don't think it's really intelligent to relax around other people.
What do you mean?
I mean, I think fools relax around other people.
I'm on because, my guard now, Claire.
Because you're being observed, you're being listened to. You're supposed to take heed and concentrate and be aware of the words that are coming out of your mouth and be responsible for them. Whereas if you're on your own, you can imagine anything and it doesn't really matter how you're behaving. Not that you're behaving inappropriately, most likely, when you're imagining something. You know, you're just going about your day, but you don't have to be focused on another being there. And I think that's also part of the attraction to horses, that you can do that in the company of a horse, although I'm convinced that a horse knows when you're not paying attention to them.
You say your mum managed to buy that pony with pig money. What's pig money mean?
Pig money? Well, I was reared on pig money, I think. My mother used to keep a sow or two, and one of the reasons she'd keep sows wasn't only because she was talented with raising pigs, but they were profitable because a sow can have a big litter. And I used to just love this, you know, and when the sow was going to have her bonds, we'd call them bonds, you probably call them piglets here. I used to go to bed in my anorak and keep my Wellington boots beside the bed, you know, because I'd just be so excited that the sow was going to have her litter.
Do they let you pick them up, baby piglets?
They don't like it. And it's one of the reasons I like them too. And if you pick up a bun of... they'll usually screech hard. I think they're great, you know. We freeze a lot of the time, but they'll actually screech as loud as they can. And they're wonderful. They come out with preformed personalities. There's the long one and the one that's lazy and the one that wants to suck two teats. And, You know, there's the runt and there's the pretty one. She's so pretty, she knows she's pretty. And I used to just love putting them all to suck, and getting the sow to lie down. And people who say dirty as a pig don't know anything about pigs, because pigs aren't dirty. And I try and pick them up then when they'd suck the sow out and put them in under a light in the corner. And there was a red bulb under a steel shade. And I used to put them all in there under the light. And they'd wriggle a little bit at first and all be upset that you interfered with them. And then they'd all kind of lie down and they'd all start kind of breathing as one. And then, you know, looking back now, I think that's what taught me what a good paragraph is.
Explain that to me. How'd that teach you?
I can't really explain it to you very well. I mean, they're all individual. They all serve a purpose. They're all different. And yet they all belong to each other. And when you put them together, they are more than the sum of their parts.
What place did music have at home when you were growing up?
Well, we weren't very musical, but we were all inclined, or most of us were inclined towards music. And we had a record player in the parlour, and my mother and father used to dance and go to dances. I was sent to accordion lessons, and I loved those, but one of the buttons on my button accordion was backwards, so I had to learn to play it with the one button in the wrong direction, which is tricky.
I'd imagine.
And I like to dance. My mother and father were good set dancers. You know, it's a type of Irish dancing, which is great exercise. I don't know why anybody would go to the gym when you can do set dancing. It's great.
A lot more fun, I imagine.
It's a lot more fun.
How much do you know about your parents' childhoods? Had they grown up in the same part of Ireland where you were raised?
They did. They grew up just a mile apart from each other. And I know very little about my father's upbringing, really, or his people. He didn't talk about them at all. He was born in 1916. I do know that his mother married three times, which was most unusual. And he was the product of her first marriage. She didn't have children with either of the other two husbands. And when my father was 11 months old, his father died, my grandfather died, and of what I don't know. And my grandmother took my father in a Moses basket to the beet field. And she put my Uncle Mick and Aunt Mary into what they call the poorhouse, kind of a workhouse for children, or until she could earn enough money in the beet fields to, I suppose she breastfed my father, he was 11 months old, until she could get enough money to get Uncle Mick and Aunt Mary back out of the workhouse. And I know very little about her. My mother used to go up and make bread in the house, and she said you would never know a thing about my grandmother, that she was always seen to be well-dressed and smiling and never said anything about anybody. And I think she was very fond of my father, but I don't know.
Mm. That's such a description of hardship to be so poverty-stricken. You have to put your children in workhouse and work outside in the field while breastfeeding your baby. I mean, it sounds like something from the 19th century.
It does. It sounds like a Thomas Hardy novel.
What about your mum and her life? She was born in 1926. What was on offer for women of her generation when she was coming of age?
Oh, not very much at all. You're expected to get married and have children and live in semi-poverty, really, I think.
Were they constrictions that she railed against, or it was just accepted that this is what life's like?
I think to some extent it's intelligent to accept that that's what life is like when that's what life has to offer. But I don't think, you know, I don't think that it was a matter of her not wanting that. I think my mother did want to get married and have children and work on a farm. I think she was good at all of that. She was a good housekeeper, a good baker. She made all our clothes. She was good with livestock, good with animals, good with money. So I think it suited her. She just married very badly in choosing my father because he wasn't good husband material. He wasn't good father material. He wasn't as good a farmer, nearly as good as her at farming, or with money, or so tactful, or skilled, or even had half her brains. So the whole misogynistic culture I knew was a lie because I was living in a house where it just obviously wasn't true. So I don't know really what was on offer for my mother. I think you had to take what was pleasurable and pleasant when it was happening.
That inequality or that difference between your parents, their difference in skills and character, is that something you think you were aware of right from a young age, or is there a moment in adolescence or later where it's suddenly clear to you that although the culture says he's the valuable and important one, you're actually seeing, well, in reality, in this family, it's her who's carrying the load?
No, I think I always knew. I don't think you'd have to have a great deal of intelligence to figure it out. I think it was obvious.
How did she talk about your future with you?
Oh, I don't think she talked very much about my future at all to me. Very little was expected of me. She was tired by the time she had me. I was her sixth child, you know, with... She had an old house, she had a marriage that was breaking down, I think she probably wanted to enjoy her life and did, and separated from my father after the house went on fire at home. And I think she began to enjoy her life then, which was wonderful. She went and lived in the town and had some independence and a pension and neighbours and wasn't isolated in the middle of a wood on a farm. But with regard to what she thought would become of me, I really don't know. What she thought would become of me.
What about you yourself, Claire? Was marriage on your radar as a young woman, a teenager?
I can't say it was. No, I didn't know. I still don't know very many happily married people. And I'm not a betting woman. You know, the chances of that happening to me are the same as it happening to other people.
Is that about human relationships, or is that about the institution of marriage in a particular society at a particular time? Like marriage in Ireland in the 70s and 80s maybe doesn't represent what's possible for men and women at other times and places.
I think things don't change that quickly. They may seem to have different attitudes, but I'm not sure. Marital rape was legal in Ireland until 1990. So I don't know why any woman would go into a church and sign that document, giving a man that power over her. I mean, I can't tell you how unattractive that is, that was to me, how unintelligent that is to do that to yourself. You may as well just stick a knife in your heart and go around with that.
Were there women in your life, in your family, who'd managed to get off that conveyor belt of marriage?
I don't know that I see it as a conveyor belt. I see it as something that you needn't do if you don't want to. And I'm sure it suits some people, and some people aren't brave enough to be on their own. You know, it's just too hard. You got to fight your corner. You got to box your corner if you're going to live as a single woman, because it's against everything. You're not supposed to be happily single and female. You are absolutely not supposed to be able to do that in that society. I don't know how other people feel really about their lives. That's a very private conversation, and mostly it is concealed, I think, even by those women who are married to the men they are married to, if they are married to men.
Is writing fiction partly a way of imagining those sorts of private conversations? Is that part of the interest?
I think I write to see. I know that's something John McGahern said. He's a very good writer, an Irish writer. But I think I that's the reason I write too. I don't know what I'm really interested in or imagining or discovering or finding or going after until I see it in text on a page. And that's something that's playful and can be delightful and manageable. You can manage it. And some of that is really teachable and learnable, rather than, you know, mysterious and a God-given talent. I don't see it that way. I think, though, I'm interested in imagining a different set of circumstances, because I think that's what civilizes us. That's why reading can be really good for us, because you imagine being something other than yourself. You entertain the possibility of being living in a different set of circumstances, under a different set of pressures than the ones you're under, and that really can be helpful in making you a better citizen, a better father, a better mother, a better teacher, whatever it is that you're at. It's civilizing. I do think that when we fail, it's because our imagination fails us.
So as a young woman, it sounds like you were pretty clear that you knew you didn't want a particular life. That would have been maybe the more obvious one, that might have been the easily one on offer in Ireland at the time. What about university? Had anyone in your family gone to university?
No, nobody had gone. Nobody had gone to university. That wasn't on the cards, you know. And I have three brothers and none of them finished secondary school.
So how did you end up at university in America?
I met a family who came over to Ireland in 1985 with a number of their friends and relatives. And I had a year of secondary school left, and they asked me before I left if I'd like to go over and when I finished and go to university and live with them. And I said I would, so I did.
What do you think they saw in you that made them make that offer?
They saw somebody who was a very good worker and was good with children and could do domestic work.
So they wanted you to come and continue that work for them in America. And university was like the softener, the sweetener to get you there.
I think that was part of it, yes.
Had you spent much time outside of Ireland before you went to America?
No, I hadn't spent any time outside of Ireland, and I think there was only one phone call between that family and my mother before I left. I don't think they even sought my parents' permission, even though I was only 17, which is an odd thing, you know, not to ask a teenager's parents if she can come and live with you. No, I had no experience really outside of being on the farm in rural Ireland.
It's such a big step to make at that age. When you look back, and you, I guess, on that flight, did it feel exhilarating or terrifying, or what did you imagine you were stepping into?
I didn't know what I was stepping into. I really didn't know what was on the far side. I was neither terrified nor exhilarated. I was just brave. I am brave.
What do you put that down to?
Well, I think you have to be responsible for your own life. And I didn't want to be a victim. I didn't want to be a victim of the society, the culture. So I think, you know, they say in the horsemanship world, you know, one of the worst things is not to try, not to give it a go. And I think I wanted to try and fail rather than to not try. I think I would have regretted that horribly.
It sounds like that time in New Orleans in America was a mixed experience for you. What were some of the good things about it? What are you glad you got out of that time there?
I liked going to Loyola University. I liked some of my teachers there and what I read. I was a good student. I was a good student in the sense also that I wasn't just reading for exams and grades. I was reading around what interested me. I was using my library card. I was, you know, I was reading a whole lot of books that weren't on the syllabus. And that was exhilarating, to be reading political theory and French philosophers and Socrates and what he was saying and all of Plato's Republic, and all of those things were exhilarating to me.
Had you been exposed to any of that at school, at high school back in Ireland?
No, I went to a very poor high school and I didn't go very often. I didn't like it at all. I loved primary school. I just excelled at primary school, and things kind of fell apart in my mother's marriage and my parents' marriage and at home as well, and we had no money, and my father gave the farm to my brother. He put it in my brother's name so he could get a pension. But he didn't give, he kept most of the pension money for himself and left £28 at that time for my mother and I to live on. And he actually said that he wasn't going to feed me. So my father taught me that I wasn't worth feeding, which is very interesting. I think that was kind of a thing that set me up for life. I just kind of promised myself I'd never put myself in that situation where I didn't have my own money.
Claire, after this opportunity you took as a young woman to go to university in New Orleans, you came back to Ireland. What was the atmosphere like in Ireland in that period in the early 1990s?
It was terrible. I came back in 92. It was the highest unemployment in Europe. I applied for 300 jobs. I got 300 rejection letters.
300?
Yeah.
What sort of jobs were you applying for?
I applied for everything. I applied to put hair dryers together and make sausages, or in a flower shop, or cleaning, or working in a kitchen in a hotel, or anything at all. But you see, I had left when I was 17. I didn't know anybody. If you didn't know anybody, you wouldn't get a job. And also, I had 2 degrees. I had 2 bachelor's degrees. But they were from the United States, even though it was a good university, and I didn't have any experience in using them. So it was a fairly bleak time. It did feel bleak because it just felt to some extent that I made a fool of myself, sending myself struggling so much to put myself through university. And I did put myself through university. I worked to go to university. It wasn't a gift. You know, I wasn't sitting around the sorority house on a Saturday night drinking a beer. And I don't know that I felt that I had done the right thing sometimes when I had come back. But, I mean, what was the alternative? The alternative was to not have an education, and that wouldn't have suited me either. So I just started writing stories and did a master's degree and started doing that. But at the time I wondered what would become of me. I suppose most of my life was, up till then, certainly guided by that feeling of what were you going to do. But I don't know that it's any different for young people now. You know, people are wondering what will they do and what kind of a job will they get, and if what they've chosen to study will suit them in the long term. You're heading into the unknown when you're that age.
It's interesting, though. I think a lot of kids who come from poor backgrounds and they get a chance at education, it can be common to really focus on the kind of degree that will get you, you know, a socially valued, well-paying job, medicine or law or something like that. Were you ever tempted to try to fit yourself into that kind of professional category?
I don't think I've had an overpowering feeling, pressure to fit in to anything very much at all. There was a school master in national school, primary school, and he used to say, keep your head down and do your own work. And I think I've had a healthy disregard for what other people are doing my whole life through. I'm not sure that I want to imitate anybody or measure myself off other people, and I don't do that with my writing either. I just write what I want to write and make it as good as I can make it.
So in those years, Claire, when you weren't getting jobs putting together hairdryers or making sausages, but you were starting to to write. Did that feel like that could be a viable income, or was it always going to be something you did because you cared about it and you loved it, but it wasn't going to pay the bills?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't presenting itself as something that would allow me to earn a living. But I've always been interested in teaching. And I got a job working on what was called a FOSS scheme, which is you work 20 hours a week. It's for the unemployed, and you get a little bit more than you would get if you were not employed. And I really wanted a job. I really wanted to teach. And I got a job teaching in a suburb of Dublin, on the south side of Dublin, in a place called Clondalkin. And I actually wound up with less money at the end of the week because I had to take the bus up to Dublin and back. But I really liked it. I just really liked that job. And then I just started teaching creative writing. And, you know, the best way to learn something is to teach it. That is the very best way to learn it. So I had to teach myself how to teach creative writing. And there were no master's degrees in creative writing in Ireland at the time.
Your first collection of stories, Antarctica, was published in 1999, followed by Walk the Blue Fields in 2007, and then these three standalone long short stories, Foster, which was adapted into that Oscar-nominated Irish language film, The Quiet Girl, then Small Things Like These and So Late in the Day, which was published in 2023. As I mentioned, the film adaptation of Small Things Like These is in cinemas here in Australia now. I think of that book as a kind of perfect story. Can you tell me about how that first came to you, that writing that story that ends up as being Small Things Like These?
I wrote it, first of all, as a short story during lockdown. COVID came and I was writer fellow at Trinity College at that time. And, of course, we all scooted home to our burrows and went on to Zoom, discovered Zoom. And I started writing a story about a boy who, with his father, goes to a Christian Brothers school for boys with a delivery of coal, and finds in the coal shed another boy just like himself. Much like himself. And his father bids him to come away. And I was really interested in that for a while. I thought, you know, what does a child think about their father? What do you think about your father when your father will leave a boy much like you in a set of circumstances like that, where you're locked inside of a coal shed in the winter and say nothing? Irish people were known to be great talkers, but we're actually, I think we've perfected the art of saying nothing, sometimes in the most cowardly way. And then my set of preoccupations shifted to the father, and I thought, you know, the child has no agency. There's nothing he can do about this set of circumstances. And what then if you're the coal man, you're the father, and you have children, and you find a child locked inside of the coal shed, and you say nothing? What does that do to you? Does that do anything to you? Do you feel any responsibility? Because the Catholic Church, you know, was in coalition with the Irish government. Or you could say that it controlled the Irish government at that time, even up until the mid-80s. People were afraid of the priests. And I think I wanted to ask the question in the text to find out, to see what it would reveal, in the sense of why people said nothing about so many children and girls being left in Magdalene laundries. I mean, it's the ultimate misogyny that they were incarcerated. Also, they weren't educated. They lost the chance of being educated. They were damaged. They had no money. And also, you know, it was their own people who did this to them, left them there. And one thing is for certain, and that is that they did not impregnate themselves. So I wanted to ask that question. It seemed pertinent. And I seemed to have touched a nerve with how the book was told through the point of view of a kind father, who himself was the child of a woman who was not married. So I think that that is why the book became so popular.
Mm. It's interesting when you describe that, that the book started with a father who doesn't do something, a father who sees a child locked in a coal shed and takes no action. But your Bill does take action, and that's the engine that drives the story.
Well, I'm not sure it is. I couldn't agree with that, because I think he doesn't know what he's going to do. And there's a moment in the book where he wonders, you know, when he's sitting at home in his comfort, and he wonders what would happen if they slowed down and had time to spare, and would they be all right, or would they just lose the run of themselves? And the book ends on Christmas Eve, when he's actually at a loose end. And he's closed the coal yard for a half day and taken the men to lunch and walks around town looking in the shop windows and then sits in the barber's chair getting a haircut. And I couldn't say that he's driven to any of that. I think that suggests that there's some kind of a plot-like thing driving that line. And I didn't know that he was going to do anything until he did something.
When I asked you to reflect or question where did your childhood courage come from, with Bill in small things like these, there's a kindness. As you say, this is what readers have responded to. Maybe it's a kindness that veers into foolishness, maybe not. It's not clear how it will play out. Where does his kindness come from?
He was loved. It doesn't matter where love comes from. You know, you take love where you find it. It really doesn't matter where it comes from. I mean, ideally, it comes from those who are closest to you, in the sense that they are the ones with whom you spend most time. But I don't think it matters. And, you know, I wrote another book called Foster, which is very much about that. I don't think it matters who loves you. So long as you are loved and minded and you learn what that is when you're young. And he did. And I think because of that, he wasn't brutalized the way other people were.
Minded is such an evocative term. And I know in Foster, that's a term used. And it's got those meanings, doesn't it, of being looked after, but also being thought of, being attended to. And it seems that both of those are really important for a child.
I think they're important for everybody at every stage of your life. To be minded when you're old, be minded when you're a wife, to be minded when you're sick, to be minded when you're getting your dementia, or to be minded when you're on your honeymoon. Doesn't matter when it is. It's a useful thing at any age, at any time.
There are many qualities, Claire, that your readers love about your writing. I mean, it's clarity, it's brevity, it's heart. What do you consider to be the most valuable skill that you bring as a writer to your material?
I don't know. I can't say that. You know, it's not something I can measure. But one of the things I really like working on is paragraph structure. I really like paragraphs because even if a paragraph is suggesting, if it's working on a level of suggestion and it's not making sense, I know I can fix it. So I'm in the business of fixing paragraphs. I don't really care about writing beautiful sentences. I think if you follow the logic and you can write your paragraphs, which usually go from the general to the particular rather than the other way around, and you care about your text in that manner, I think it will be rewarded if you are a thoughtful person. If you aren't thoughtful, it's very unlikely you will write thoughtful prose.
Help me understand why it's not the level of the word or the sentence, but the paragraph. Why is that the structure that's the key?
Well, I think we're back to the pigs under the light in the corner that, sentences are gregarious. They like the company of other sentences. They're social. If you put a short sentence, for example, out there on its own, it just looks like it's out there on its own. You know, did you ever see a daffodil on its own? You just think, oh, the poor daffodil. You know, that's why Wordsworth had a crowd of daffodils. You know, he knew what he was talking about. He knew that daffodils are gregarious and, like, they need all that other yellow to feel their yellowness. And sentences are the same. They want to turn into a paragraph. And so that's what I'm interested in making. I'm not interested in writing a beautiful sentence. Also, there's a concept, you know, of all right that must seem terribly plain and fundamental or basic. Actually, basic is something that people might regard it as, but there are lots of people who will take the time to decorate their work, if you will. But I don't know an awful lot of people, too many people, who really take the time to make it all right. And, you know, I work with a horseman here and here in Queensland in the Brisbane Valley. And, you know, one of the things that I'm really interested in when I'm coming to him, which sounds, again, like such a basic thing, but it's not, is my horse being all right? And, like, what does that mean? Well, it means, is he all right going into a puddle? Is he all right stepping into the lather of foam on the edge of the sea? Is he all right getting into the horse box? Is he all right travelling in the horse box? Is he all right with me getting up and down on him and stopping him in all gates and backing up and going beside a gate and going through a field of sheep? And, you know, if you bother and you're that interested in making everything all right, you'd be surprised how far ahead you are of other people who, you know, don't have that all right at work. And I feel that my ability to fix paragraphs and compose and fix paragraphs makes my prose all right. And then it can travel, it can go somewhere, it can move, and it can actually move people.
Both Foster and Small Things Like These are on the school syllabus in Ireland. How does that feel?
Great. Great. It's just lovely to have so many young readers who are interested in looking at and thinking about a time before them in the recent past and thinking about how things were for women and girls. And imagining being that in that set of circumstances, it feels civilizing and necessary and a privilege.
Does the fact that your books exist and that they're studied by students at high school now say that Ireland has moved quite away from where it was when you were a girl and let alone when your mum was a girl?
I like to think so. I like to think we're headed in that direction. I believe there are fresh difficulties now with what's going on online and fresh ways to objectify and ruin women with what is posted on the internet and all of that. And the violence is a different and more insidious type of violence, perhaps. But I do think things seem to be improving.
You've mentioned horses right through this conversation, Claire, right from the pony that your mum managed to buy with pig money to Ken Faulkner, who you come here to Queensland to work with. What is it about horses that has always so strongly appealed to you?
I think there's something beautiful about being carried, that a horse would allow you to do all of that and carry you through a storm. There's something noble, and to think about who they have carried through the centuries, and they've gone into the battlefields and tilled the land and been pioneers. You know, people could not have been pioneers. We couldn't have done what we have done. I also think the horse's heart is broken by people, and that the horse has a knowledge of what human beings are like.
Why do you say that?
I don't know why I say that. I have some kind of strange belief in historical consciousness, And horses were around millions of years before we ever appeared and started using them as transport and all else. And I think there's some kind of a knowledge of what a human being is like that's carried inside of the horse's heart, and that they know we're predators. And to be able to turn that around and get the horse to regard you, the predator, as a friend is delightful.
Well, when you said that, whatever your phrasing was, that you shouldn't trust being, or it's foolish to trust another, to be in the same space as another human, I guess even more so for a horse when they are the prey and we the predator. That is an enormous leap for a creature to take. When Ken Faulkner came on Conversations, I remember him talking about the way that horses were treated and handled when he was a kid growing up in the country, that they were sort of there as tools, almost like as you would treat an inanimate object. And he had to really learn, as a grown man, a different way of being with horses. How do you approach those animals that are new to our species?
Well, with the Brumby training down at Ken's, Ken brings them into the round pen, you know, because they haven't been handled at all except maybe gelded and wormed, and, you know, they're rounded up and put on a cattlery and brought in and gelded and wormed, and that would be it. So, of course, we wouldn't have I wouldn't have a chance of catching a horse like that. I don't know how to lasso, so he lassos, he ropes them. And just tries to do that as gently and humanely as possible, and then gets a halter and lead on him, and then he hands you the end of the lead, and if he feels that is safe, and then you do your ground skills and work on getting the trust going between you, and see if they'll be all right. Well, with contact, with a little bit of pressure, with a little bit of more pressure, and pressure under movement, and pressure in different gates. And when I mean pressure, I just mean, you know, the contact of the rope or the contact of the halter. I don't mean anything harsh.
Do you have to be in a certain state, a certain kind of quality of mind or presence for that to go well?
I do. I think you have to be present and fairly level-headed and calm. I think hot-headed people make poor... I don't think hot-headed people are very good at anything, actually. I think you have to be fairly calm and have a long fuse. They say mules, you know, aren't stubborn, that they just learn to outweigh you. They're waiting for you to lose your patience. I think that's delightful.
So do you think you're good with horses because you naturally have that long fuse, or have horses taught you to develop that?
I think it's a combination of things. I think it's what Ken taught me. I think my attitude is probably fairly good. I just want it to happen. You know, I want it to be all right. I'm not looking for perfection and beauty. I'm not competitive at all. I'm really not a competitive person at all. I just like doing things well, which is an entirely different thing. It's got nothing to do with anybody else. And it's just lovely to see a horse grow emotionally, and they change so quickly, and they're so forgiving. And their memories, I think, are astonishing, which can be a bit frightening because you think, well, what if I'm teaching them the wrong thing? They're going to remember all of this. And they get it before we do, really. But it's just a lovely thing to witness. It's a lovely thing to be a part of. And also, I have a sitting down job. When I'm working, I'm sitting down. You know, if I'm reading, if I'm writing, I'm sitting down. And that is something that I don't like about my work. It's a necessary part of my work. So being outside with the horses is lovely. You're on your feet.
What horses are in your life at the moment back in Ireland?
I have an ex-race horse, a gelding, who's getting older. He's a gentleman horse. And then I have a mare who is a thoroughbred mare, and I started her with all of what Ken taught me. And she's just so, they're so quiet and easily handled and happy horses, and I've the care of another thoroughbred mare who's quite nervous, belonging to my sister-in-law. And she's just a companion for a yearling I have now. She's a thoroughbred Connemara cross, and she's just 1 year old. So I'm setting up an obstacle course for her at the moment. And when I get back from the super camp in the Brisbane Valley, I'm going to get her going over a few things and see what she likes and doesn't like to do.
Are you riding every day when you're at home? Are you with horses every day?
No, I'm with horses every day I'm home, but I'm not riding every day.
What about writing? Does that happen every day? You're one of those people who sit down at their desk every day?
No, I'm not. I just go in waves at things. And at the moment I'm making notes for a novel that's going to be set on the farm where I was raised. And as soon as it's ready, it'll start going down on the screen, and then I'll be there every day. You have to be there every day, I think, for that, when that starts happening. But you can get it done in the mornings and go out with the horses in the afternoons usually, and it's all right.
You live on a farm yourself now. What does it look like? Your home farm.
It's an old house from the 1700s down an old avenue. In a fairly sheltered spot, not far from the sea, not far from the woods or the lake. It's got a lot of old trees around it, and an old courtyard and an arena and stables, and it's nicely sheltered. I like it very much. It's got a pleasant aspect.
I can only imagine if you could time travel back to that little girl with her pigtails riding about on that pony, she'd be pretty happy with the life you've built for yourself.
I think so. Yeah, I even have a saddle. And it looks like I'm taking another one back, this time from Australia. So I have two Australian saddles now to look forward to. But yeah, all that bareback riding didn't do me any harm, though, I don't think.
It's a real pleasure to have you on Conversations. Thank you so much for being my guest.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Sarah.
Claire Keegan was my guest today. Claire doesn't do many long interviews, so if you know some fans of her writing, make their day and share this conversation. And if you want to hear my conversation with Ken Faulkner, who's Claire's Australian horsemanship teacher, we'll link to that at our website too. This conversation was produced by Alice Moldovan and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.